In this first hour of our program, we'll be talking about Korea, about the relationship between North Korea and South Korea and the possibility for reunification. We'll also talk about the relationships between the two Koreas and the United States. And our guest with the program today is a journalist who spent a lot of time following politics in East Asia. His name is Selig Harrison. He's former Washington Post bureau chief in Northeast Asia and South Asia. He's written a number of books about Asian affairs. He served as senior fellow and director of Asian studies at the Brookings Institution and also was for 22 years senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He has authored a new book that's just out that's titled Korean Endgame, the subtitle A Strategy for Reunification and U.S. Disengagement. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Is out now. Of course, if you want to look at it, you should be able to find it in the bookstore. We'll try to talk this morning about some of the basic issues that he raises in the book. And of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, and we ask that so we can get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving. Anyone is welcome to join the conversation here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Harrison, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
I know.
There are a number of things we can talk about, and certainly we'll want to talk about some of the recent developments here. The announcement that Mr. Koizumi, the Prime Minister of Japan, will be going to Korea, and some moves towards better relations between North and South, reopening of the rail line between the two and so forth. But I think perhaps I would like to start by talking about a little bit about North Korea, as you do in your book, and look at what seems to be, in many people's minds, a basic assumption. We see it in popular media as it reports on North Korea, and I think you argue that many people within the foreign policy community think this as well, and that is the idea that North Korea is on the verge of collapse. I think you make the argument also in the book that perhaps there have been some people in the government of the United States that have said, well, we really don't need to deal with the government of North Korea because sometime in the near future, it's not going to be there anymore.
I think that, you know, that near future, they keep moving it up. Started out, you know, I mean, when the Clinton administration negotiated its nuclear freeze agreement with North Korea in 1994, which was very important and a real gesture on the part of North Korea to reflecting its desire to normalize relations with the United States. There was a lot of criticism from Republicans and conservatives in Congress, and basically the Clinton people said to them, well, they don't have to worry because it probably won't be around long enough that we have to fulfill the conditions of this agreement. This is just buying time. So there's been an implicit feeling that North Korea might collapse, even during the Clinton period, and they eventually did move toward, in the last year of the Clinton administration, toward some significant moves to normalize relations with North Korea. Now you have, I think, in the Bush administration, a much stronger feeling that it not only is likely to collapse, but it should be made to collapse, and that we should be putting as much pressure on it as possible to bring that about, and certainly shouldn't do anything to prop them up. That's kind of the underlying reason, I think, for many of the Bush policies toward North Korea.
Hmm. Well, let me then ask the question, is the government of North Korea on the verge of collapse?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's wishful thinking. The North Korea has a very powerful political ethos, nationalistic ethos. It had a leader in Kim Il-sung until 1994 who was really a demigod to the people, and the mystique of Kim Il-sung is still very much alive, even though his son, Kim Jong-il, doesn't have the kind of absolute grip over the situation in North Korea that his father had, and he doesn't have the nationalistic mystique to the same extent. Kim Il-sung was identified with the anti-Japanese struggle of Korea, and the Korean War, having led Korea through the North Korea through the Korean War, and Kim Jong-il doesn't have the same charisma. So it's not it's not as firm a political situation there as it was before 1994, but it'll take a long time for that Kim Il-sung mystique to wear off. And it's still a very tight political ship. It's, of course, a totalitarian system, a repressive system, and that is the basic reason why it's not likely to collapse. But, you know, a totalitarian system can collapse if it doesn't have anything really going for it politically. Of course, North Korea's economic troubles are very real. It was, and that is, so economically, it has been stagnant in many respects. It's a disintegrating economy. And the question is how long you can have economic disintegration without having political consequences. But North Korea is sort of muddling through, I think is the proper word, all kinds of short-term economic fixes. The international community doesn't want to see mass starvation in North Korea, so there's been food aid, which has been very helpful to them. But I think that although economic problems are very real, and that's why they're reaching out to the United States, to Japan, to South Korea, that doesn't mean that they're going to collapse politically. They've got great staying power, I think.
Mm. Kim Il-sung died in 1994, and even though his son, Kim Jong-il, had been designated to be the successor some years before, at the time, there were many questions about whether Kim Jong-il would be able to consolidate power, whether the elites in the country would accept him, and there were a lot of questions about what kind of leader for the country he might be. And I think still today, when you look at stories about Korea and about him, he has continued to be described as a sort of mysterious, shadowy figure, and about the only thing we know is he doesn't like to fly. Can you say some things about Kim Jong-il and how his performance has been so far, and whether indeed it would seem at this time that one would have to say that his position as leader of the country is secure?
Well, what happened after Kim Il-sung's death was that you really had a kind of bloodless military coup in North Korea, in which the armed forces, which until that time had been subservient to the Workers' Party, the Communist Party, basically formed an alliance with Kim Jong-il. They need him because he's the link with the legitimacy provided by the memory of Kim Il-sung. And he certainly needs them because a lot of needs the armed forces to bolster his control, because there's a great division in North Korea between old guard hawks, ideologues in the Workers' Party, and the forces of cautious, pragmatic reform identified with Kim Jong-il. Now, reform, of course, should be much faster in North Korea by any logical standard than it is, but the fact is that Kim Jong-il has been trying to sort of inch along without upsetting the political structure there and inviting the opposition of the hawks to too great an extent toward some cautious economic reform. But I think the point is that he's dependent on the armed forces. It's an alliance. I wouldn't say he's a front man for them. He's much more than that. But it's a very complex relationship. We don't know as much about it as we would like to know. He's not in complete control. On the other hand, he's not just a front man. He's a link with the memory of Kim Il-sung. He's not a political animal to the extent his father was. His father was very gregarious. I met him twice. He was a real hands-on politician who ruled, kept control not only through repression, but also because he was very charismatic and a very magnetic personality. But Kim Jong-il doesn't have the magnetism, and he doesn't have the political instincts of his father, but he's basically in control now with the help of the armed forces.
We are talking this morning about Korea, and our guest is Selig Harrison. He's a former Washington Post bureau chief in Northeast Asia and South Asia, and has written a lot about Asian politics. His new book is titled Korean Endgame, A Strategy for Reunification and U.S. Disengagement. It's published by the Princeton University Press, and indeed takes a look at relations between the North and South, possibility for reunification, and about the relationship between the United States and the two Koreas, and how he really makes the argument that, in fact, our policies have been counterproductive, that they have gotten in the way of improved relations between the two Koreas, and, in fact, that our policies have made it very difficult for us to have much in the way of positive relations with the North. Any of this fair game for questions, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. South Korea has been a country. It was proclaimed, the Republic of South Korea, or Republic of Korea, which is South Korea, proclaimed in 1948. And from that point until the late 80s, it was a one-party state. And there has been a lot of change in Korea since, although one might ask just how much. Can you talk a little bit about the current government of South Korea and the political environment there?
Well, the current government, headed by President Kim Dae-jung, won the Nobel Peace Prize, of course, for his efforts to normalize relations with North Korea, represents the forces in South Korea that want to cool it with North Korea and are prepared for coexistence, leading to a loose confederation in which the two sides would both keep their armies, keep control of their borders, but would have one flag up at the DMZ saying this is a confederated Korea in dealing with the outside world, but in which there would still be two separate states with a structure for economic cooperation. And the keynote of the present government's policy is to promote enough economic cooperation between South and North Korea that North Korea won't collapse. Because at first, after what happened in Germany, there was a feeling in South Korea that we ought to promote a collapse of North Korea. It might be possible, they felt, after Kim Il-sung died. But then they began to realize how much it was costing Germany, West Germany, to try to bring East Germany into a unified Germany, and there was a change in the consensus within the ruling groups in South Korea. Kim Dae-jung came along at a time when that consensus had begun to crystallize, that it would be cheaper and more stable for South Korea to move toward economic cooperation with North Korea and help it to gradually change its economy, become more like South Korea economically, gradually move toward a confederation after coexistence, and then another 20 or 30 years later, move to a full unification. So that view is reflected in Kim Dae-jung government, but believe me, the forces opposed to that view are very strong. There are still strong forces in South Korea who would like to put pressure on North Korea, who don't really believe in a goal of a confederation. And I must say that to some extent this is rooted in a kind of conspiracy theory. I mean, there is a strong military industrial complex in South Korea, 150 companies or so, defense industries, that have connections with American defense industries, of course, that have quite a stake in the continued high levels of military expenditure in South Korea, which, of course, can only be justified if you have tensions between North and South Korea. I'm not saying these forces want a war, of course not. But they're very reluctant to see the kinds of arms reductions, for example, that North Korea wants to see, mutual force reductions between North and South Korea. North Korea cannot afford the level of defense spending that the present confrontation involves and is ready for the mutual reduction of their armed forces. South Korea can afford to, they can have it both ways. They can, they have U.S. help in their U.S. forces in Korea, 37,000 U.S. troops, gives them a cushion. They don't need mutual force reductions the way North Korea does. So there is a lobby in South Korea that sort of viscerally resists real tension reduction, which, of course, has to include military tension reduction. But I think after Kim Dae-jung departs from office at the end of this year, not clear what the regime is going to be in power, but it seems likely to be one that will be harder line toward North Korea. And the U.S. policy makes it very difficult for the North Korean moderates, or pragmatists is perhaps the best word, who favor a reduction of tensions with South Korea to prevail, because as long as there's tension between the U.S. and North Korea, and some people in Washington talking about a preemptive strike and that sort of thing, axis of evil, then the hawks in North Korea can say to Kim Jong-il, you're risking our security if you open up to South Korea too quickly and too much, and that, of course, plays into issues like the reconnection of the railroads between North and South, mm-hmm. which has been one of the hopeful issues that North and South have been talking about as a follow-up to the thaw that began between North and South Korea in June 2000 when Kim Dae-jung went to Pyongyang and met Kim Jong-il.
The United States has a military presence there. We're supporters of the government of South Korea. We maintain this official belligerent sort of posture in regards to the North. And, of course, now everybody knows in Mr. Bush's famous axis of eagle phrase, he included the government of North Korea. And part of the reason that we are there, that we continue to be there with these 37,000 troops, is that, first of all, we believe that there is some potential for threat from the North against the South, the possibility that the North might attempt to reunify by force. And so we have maintained these troops there. What is the current thinking about the kind of threat that the South faces from the North?
Well, I think there's general agreement that the forward deployment of North Korean artillery and armor so close to the demilitarized zone, so close to the border with South Korea, would pose a great threat of military threat to South Korea in the event of a war, because it's very close to Seoul. Seoul is close to the DMZ, capital of South Korea. And there's no question that North Korea's forward deployments are a very potent potential threat to South Korea. But why are they there? They are there. They are forward deployed. I have learned in dealing with North Korea since 1972 and going there seven times, talking with lots of their generals, that the reason they're forward deployed is because they're afraid of us. They think that American air power deployed in South Korea, together with the sophisticated aircraft that we've given to South Korea and sold to South Korea, which works together with the American Air Force, could stage a preemptive strike against North Korea. And so the only way they can offset that threat is to have forward deployment of their own forces. It would make it too costly for the United States to stage a preemptive strike. I think the idea that North Korea would once has those forces forward deployed in order to reunify Korea militarily is way out of date. I mean, you know, they did attack South Korea in 1950, half a century ago, and the Korean War was certainly the result of North Korean aggression. But at that time, of course, they were allied with the Soviet Union and China. And Joseph Stalin went along with Kim Il-sung in the decision to move against South Korea. And now you've got a situation where both Russia and China deal with South Korea on an even closer basis, really, than they do with North Korea. I mean, things have changed. There have been tremendous geopolitical changes, and the notion North Korea would have no help if it staged an adventure against South Korea, which South Korea is now militarily much stronger than it's ever been before. It has its own military industrial establishment, makes a lot of its own weapons with American help, and because we're in South Korea, it has the combination of the U.S. deterrent plus its own forces. So I think that when you look at it and you talk to the American military people, they don't really believe most of them, I think, now that the danger really is of an attempt to reunify the peninsula militarily, but rather we're there to limit the costs and damage if there should be an accidental war, or if North Korea should do something on a more limited level. But the whole trend since the end of the Cold War has been, from the North Korea's point of view, to look for peace, because they lost their economic support, as well as their military support, from Russia and China. And after 1990, they haven't had the fuel subsidies, the food subsidies. They've just been adrift economically, and they had to turn to the West and to Japan and to South Korea to try to open up to the outside world, but they didn't want to do it too fast. The hardliners in control there and lose the political control that they have. Now, Kim Jong-il, since 1994, has been moving more positively toward cautious reform and cautious opening. But unfortunately, just as we were getting it, the U.S. was beginning to move in that direction seriously. In the last year of Bill Clinton, we had a change of administration to now dominated by people who are way back to where we were, perhaps during the Cold War. I mean, their thinking is totally out of touch with what is really going on in North Korea. And I think that even the neighbors of North Korea, I mean, the event that just occurred today in the announcement that Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi is going to go to North Korea and meet Kim Jong-il on September the 17th is very important. And it reflects the fact that Japan doesn't want to see military trouble in Northeast Asia. They don't like the North Koreans. In fact, there's a sort of chemical distaste that Koreans and Japanese in general have had for historical and cultural reasons toward each other. And the part of the Koreans, the legacy of Japanese colonialism, is a big obstacle to normalizing relations. But when it comes to military tensions in the Korean Peninsula, it could lead to a war which would inevitably have big consequences for Japan, refugees, reconstruction costs later, and all sorts of things. You know, this decision by Prime Minister Koizumi to go to North Korea is a very important development. It does reflect concern about the United States' drift of U.S. policy toward North Korea and what this could mean in the development of military tensions. I think the most important consequence of it will be very relevant to the United States. You know, the big issue, big concern of the Bush administration has been North Korean missiles, mm-hmm. both the missiles they are developing and the missiles they export to the Middle East. And North Korea, the Clinton administration, got North Korea to declare a moratorium on missile testing after its 1998 missile test, which alarmed Japan very much. And that moratorium was linked to the talks on the normalization of relations with the U.S. As long as those talks continued, the missile testing moratorium on the part of North Korea would stay in place. Now, the Bush administration hasn't been moving toward talks on normalization of relations, and there's been concern that this North Korea, which has talked about keeping this moratorium in effect until 2003, would resume missile testing. Now, the fact that Koizumi, the reason I mention all this is that Koizumi's decision to go to North Korea, while it will not lead to immediate moves toward the normalization of relations, there are many difficult issues, does mean that there'll be a thaw, a period of fluidity while these negotiations go on, and it's very unlikely in that climate, I think, that North Korea would resume missile tests. So I think Koizumi's visit buys time and will help to stabilize the whole situation and make new North Korean missile tests very unlikely.
We are at our midpoint here and have a caller we will get right to, but I would again like to introduce our guest for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in here in the last 10 or 15 minutes. We're speaking with Selig Harrison. He is former Washington Post bureau chief in Northeast Asia and South Asia. He has written 5 books about Asian affairs. He served as senior fellow and director of Asian studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and also for 22 years was senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is the author of the book Korean Endgame, A Strategy for Reunification and U.S. Disengagement. The book discusses many of these issues, the relationship between the two Koreas and between Korea and the United States, published by the Princeton University Press. Questions here on this program are welcome. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have a caller to talk with in Belgium, Illinois, on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Moments ago, you introduced the thoughts about our present person in the White House. I hate to call him a president. His leadership is woefully lacking. But he lumped North Korea in with all these terrorists. And it's interesting how he lumps everybody in with terrorists, even though, as you're pointing out, North Korea essentially has no ability to promote very much in the way of terrorism, do they?
I guess they have the ability to, if they wanted to, but they haven't wanted to for a long time, because during the Cold War, there's no question that North Korea did some things that you could categorize as terrorist activities against South Korea, and there hasn't really been anything that you could call terrorism on the part of North Korea for at least 20 years.
Well, as you were saying, though, they're so impoverished and they have so little money, they can barely support their own people, let alone sending terrorists into other portions.
The whole thrust of their policy is to reach out to the outside world in ways that are they consider consistent with their self-respect, so they're not bowing down and making all the concessions on their side, and they desperately need economic help from the United States, Japan, and South Korea, particularly in the energy field, where they have lost all their Soviet and Chinese support. So I agree with you. I think that they have nothing to gain from terrorist tactics at this time, and the group in control in North Korea at the present time is not likely to move in that direction at all. And I think the Bush administration is really strengthened all the bad guys in North Korea by lumping it together with Iraq and Iran. And, of course, we could get into discussions about those U.S. policies toward Iraq and Iran also.
Yes.
But I think that it's particularly unfortunate at this period when you have a struggle between hawks and doves in North Korea to see American policy strengthening the hawks.
Yes, it is very unfortunate. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Maybe just, I don't know, I want to put too fine a point on this, but I'm interested, again, in this the issue of North Korea and its potential as a threat not only to South Korea, but to the region and perhaps the larger world, which, again, is something that it would seem the United States, the current United States government, is very concerned about, as Mr. Bush has placed it in this axis of evil along with Iran and Iraq. Underscoring this just this week, I believe, an Undersecretary of State, John Bolton, who is an arms control negotiator, was in South Korea. He was in Seoul. He made a speech and once again outlined the concerns of the United States vis-a-vis North Korea and its missile business, and said again that the United States believes that North Korea is a leader in sales of ballistic missile components and expertise around the world. It's something that we're very concerned about. And again, I guess gets me back to thinking this question. Well, does North Korea, by virtue of this activity, constitute some sort of threat to the region, to the world, to the United States?
Well, you have to distinguish between the development of missiles by North Korea for its own armed forces, capable of reaching Japan or someday the United States, although there's terrible exaggeration and misrepresentation concerning when that might be possible. There's a distinction between missiles and missile exports. The missile export issue is very clear. North Korea, which doesn't have effective international trade relationships to earn foreign exchange, faces economic sanctions from the United States that make it more difficult for it to join the world and to trade and to earn foreign exchange, has used missile exports, the export of its missile technology and components to Iran, Iraq, Syria, Pakistan, to earn foreign exchange. And lately, we accused them of selling something in the way of a component to Yemen. But the point to be made here is that they have made it very clear that they are willing to reach an agreement to end those missile exports in return for U.S. steps that would compensate them for what they would lose in foreign exchange earnings by stopping their missile exports. Those negotiations, there were negotiations at the Clinton administration, which were quite advanced, and it's very clear that they're ready to do that. And I think the Bush administration should give priority to negotiating an agreement to end for North Korea to end missile exports. So, in a sense, what they say is right, but their policy is totally misguided because it just ignores the fact that North Korea is ready to negotiate an end to this issue, as they are on many issues, on a basis of quid pro quos that take both sides' interests into account. After all, North Korea says, look, you have lots of missiles, and you export the missile parts and components to lots of people you like, so it's totally inequitable for you to ask us to just to stop them. But if you will make it worth our while, of course, we're willing to make a deal with you on this. And we don't think that way. We're adopting this posture that we're the good guys. It's okay for us to have nuclear weapons and to have missiles and anything we want because we're the superpower, the benign superpower, and we can decide who the bad guys are. So the missile export issue could be resolved. The missile development of missiles is a more complicated issue. It is part of North Korea's desire, first, to have a missile capabilities that it can use to deter any American military, a preemptive strike on North Korea. So it's just like the forward deployment of its forces. It's defensive. They would have nothing to gain by lobbing a missile to the United States and inviting an American nuclear attack. They know that we could destroy them right away. We have all kinds of nuclear weapons in the Pacific. It's a defensive deterrent, a military posture. But they haven't got very far with it yet because they don't have the money to buy the foreign equipment that they need. They have some missiles of very poor targeting that might be able to reach Japan. There's pretty good evidence based on the 1998 missile test, that they could get a missile somewhere in Japan with a rather poor range of poor accuracy in the targeting. There's absolutely no reason to believe that they're anywhere near being able to deliver a missile to Alaska, let alone other parts of the United States. But it is a fact that they are trying to develop that capability, both as a deterrent and for bargaining purposes. They've indicated they're willing to stop that if we are willing to normalize relations with them and become friends instead of potential enemies. Mm.
The Korean War has been over for almost 50 years, but yet the two sides have yet to sign a peace treaty. So here, this has officially been unresolved now for close to half a century. And now it seems that there are people both in the North and the South who believe it's time to start moving toward a resolution, even though, as you have explained, there may well be people on both sides who are not interested in that. But there are people who are, and it seems fairly clear, you seem to be suggesting that the policy of the United States, the fact that we have the military presence in the South, and that we officially have this belligerent sort of relationship with the North, that all of that really stands in the way of the move toward reunification. And you suggest that it's time, and also suggest a kind of strategy for the United States disengagement. Can you talk a little bit about how you might see that happening?
Well, I don't think the United States should disengage unilaterally. What I have said is that North Korea sees our military presence as a threat, and that if we take that into account and are willing to make changes in the nature of our military presence, including some force withdrawals, we could get the North Korean concessions that would lead to their reduction of their military threat, the pullbacks from the DMZ of their armor and their artillery. In other words, we should use arms control concessions, changes in our force posture, the redeployment of our forces, which are right on the DMZ now, pull them back, see what pulling our Air Force out of South Korea, which is the heart of their fears concerning a preemptive strike, what that could buy us in North Korean concessions. I'm advocating an arms control process, the ultimate goal of which would be the disengagement of the United States from the Korean Peninsula half a century after the Korean War, but not unilateral disengagement. It's based on the assumption that North Korea, not the assumption, my findings, which I show in the book very carefully, that North Korea is ready to pull back its forces and take part in a whole thaw in the Korean Peninsula, if we are. And so what I'm saying is that it takes two to tango, and you can't just keep saying, as the Bush administration is to North Korea, pull back your forces to show us you're good guys and you want peace. That is so unrealistic that it's really ridiculous, and I don't think they're serious about it. It's part of their posture to just put the onus on North Korea for being a bad guy and not really seriously pursuing negotiations. But I think that the long-term objective of the United States should be to disengage its forces all these years after the Korean War. But we shouldn't do it unilaterally. We should do it as part of a process that gets North Korea to pull back its forces. And I argue in my book, and I think I show, that this can be done.
Perhaps also that you could talk a little bit about how you might see the process of reunification of the North and South going, because you outline a series of steps that might make that happen over a significant period of time. We're not talking about something that's going to happen very quickly, something that would begin with some kind of confederation between the two, and that over a period of time would move toward an eventual reunification of the country. How would you sort of see that happening?
Well, I think that it all depends. All the what happens between the United States and North Korea and North and South Korea is closely linked. I don't think that North-South Korea relations will go very far in improvement, toward improvement, in a climate in which the United States and North Korea are in a confrontational mode. I think that that just simply makes it seem unsafe to the North Korean military to begin to open up, particularly things that involve the relaxation of the North Korean military posture. For example, now they're talking, very promising negotiations, about reconnecting the railroad line that existed, went from North Korea through South Korea, connected them before the Korean War. And that involves a part of the demilitarized zone, part of the front between North and South Korea being breached by a railroad, mines being removed, forces being removed. Now, in a climate where the Bush administration, where Mr. Bolton goes to Seoul and makes threatening noises, the Undersecretary of State John Bolton, who was just in South Korea, as you said, in that kind of a climate, the North Korean military resists real movement on issues like that. Economic progress between the two is directly linked to the U.S.-North Korean progress. For example, you have a zone near Kaesong, which would be an economic development zone where about 800 South Korean companies would go into North Korea in an area where there would be a special infrastructure, and the two would cooperate. Now, that involves crossing the demilitarized zone with all kinds of things to make that zone possible. So I don't think that you're going to see much progress, real progress. You're going to see a modus vivendi, I think, continuing after Kim Dae-jung's departure from office as president of South Korea. But the real progress is being blocked by the U.S. posture. Also, I think that in the long-range sense, as long as you have American forces in South Korea, you have you're giving a subsidy to South Korea that relieves the pressure on them, the necessity to reach military understandings with North Korea and to have a thaw with North Korea. So the forces in South Korea who want to move toward détente with the North would be strengthened to the extent that there is a thaw between the U.S. and North Korea that would include changes in our military posture in South Korea.
I think that's a really interesting point, an important one, that our continuing military presence there is a disincentive for people in the South, or that is, it makes it easier for them to say, well, we don't need to deal with the North because they don't have to deal with the real security issue because the United States is there.
That's right. We're making much less expensive for them.
Yes.
If they were to have to replace, if they faced the necessity for militarily replacing the degree of security that we give them with our force presence there and our commitment to intervene, they would face tremendous costs, quite apart from our nuclear umbrella, which is a whole other issue. And if they had to pay those costs, then, of course, they'd begin to think much more seriously about whether they really want to do that and whether it wouldn't be better to make peace.
Yeah. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Selig Harrison. He's a former journalist, worked for a number of years for the Washington Post in Asia. He's author of the book Korean Endgame, A Strategy for Reunification and U.S. Disengagement. It's published by the Princeton University Press. And questions are welcome. We have someone else here to bring in Champaign County. Line number one.
Hi. Sorry, I wasn't able to listen to the entirety, but maybe the role of China and the U.S. relations with China, if you haven't mentioned it, could bear some repeating. We have, I think, a very belligerent stance from the Bush administration, and actually some of it may have predate in the Clinton administration. There was this nuclear posture document that was leaked some time ago that included China and even Rump Russia as a possible, you know, target for nuclear confrontation sometime. We have this and also the Star Wars program, which is now talking about forward deployed, you know, ocean platforms, and from the Chinese point of view, it looks like an encirclement of China. So it just seems that the Bush administration is very hesitant, would be very hesitant if this is really their entire mindset, that they're that they want this kind of nuclear standoff to continue, and don't want to make other kinds of policy changes or directions, that they'd be very hesitant to give up, you know, military bases in Korea.
That's, you put your finger on a very important point. I agree with everything you have said. The even if the, basically the Pentagon position is that even if there's a thaw, there were to be a thaw between North and South Korea, we should still keep our forces in Korea for China, for Asian reasons. They talk about ensuring the stability of the region. But what they mean, of course, is it's just part of our posture toward China. Of course, the actual level of U.S. force presence in South Korea is not enough to deal with China. But that's one of the arguments they put forward, and I think that China, from its point of view, certainly doesn't want U.S. forces to stay in Korea after the reunification of the country. They're tolerating a U.S. force presence now, and I say tolerating. They don't really like it, but they aren't actively trying to get us out of there. But I think if we were to attempt to stay there during a period of confederation or during after reunification, which many American strategists want to do, China would certainly be opposed to that. It would be totally incompatible with friendly U.S. relations with China. The whole nuclear issue that you mentioned is very important because China's been offering for many years to have a no-first-strike agreement with the United States. We don't like no-first-strike agreements. We want to keep complete freedom of action. And that impedes any agreement to denuclearize Korea and to really end the possibility of a nuclear North Korea and a nuclear South Korea, which is another problem we don't have time to really talk about. And if China is willing, I think, to participate in a regional agreement in which the China, Russia, Japan, the United States, North and South Korea would agree that none of the powers signing this agreement would manufacture nuclear weapons in the case of North and South Korea, or introduce nuclear weapons in the case of the United States, Russia, China, and Japan. So I think that the China factor here is very important. China wants stability in Korea. It wants a gradual process of reunification. It wants the U.S. to gradually get out.
Well, just take issue with a matter of semantics. You say we don't like first use. You're talking about the Pentagon, the government.
Exactly.
I think you could get an 80% approval of that at the you know, the common person's level. I mean, the nuclear weapons are basically have to be against civilians. It should be a war crime just to even consider using it and use it as a threat, I think, and that's not something that's heard often, and maybe it sounds fringy, but I think actually if one explained that in those terms that, you know, there's just no way that a nuclear weapon can be used in any kind of way that isn't a war crime.
I certainly agree with you that most of the American people would accept the idea that no first use agreements are in the American interest, and I think that you know, this is It's a very important basic issue in arms control, our whole arms control policy. I mean to suggest that when I said we, I meant the United States,
the U.S.
the powers that be at
government.
The time.
Sure. As we have discussed, the North and the South are making moves to improve relations. They're talking about restoring this rail link to conduct talks between their militaries on the issues of safety along the border. The South is going to be providing some agricultural assistance to the North. And I believe that also part of this whole deal was, and of course this has to be connected with the restoring of transportation links, is that there's been talk of making it possible for people to visit, because of course families were divided when Korea was divided, and people would like to go back and forth either way. It's also interesting to think about just indeed if that was possible, how much that might help in terms of reunification if we get personal relationships built and reestablished across the DMZ. Has much of that happened yet?
Well, this really brings to a focus the conflicts within North Korea, the ambivalence in North Korea over this whole question of contacts. North Korean hardliners are afraid to open up family reunions too much because they don't want this process of interchange at the popular level to go too far. People in the North will learn more about how much difference there is between North and South Korea, between the standard of living in the two countries, how much richer the South Korean relatives are. And they don't want South Koreans wandering around in the villages of North Korea. So they are behaving like a repressive totalitarian regime on this issue. And they sort of dole out concessions on family reunions very, very carefully. At the same time, they have been letting more South Koreans come to North Korea where there is a reason for it, having to do with an economic deal, negotiations, the building of the nuclear power plants that the United States, South Korea, and Japan agreed to do under the 1994 Nuclear Freeze Agreement, interchange between North and South Korea, including some journalists, has increased. They're very careful about letting their own people go to South Korea for the same reasons that they are careful about the family reunions. So this, I think that there has been a great increase, however, in the last 5 years in the number of South Koreans who've been to North Korea, and that the businessmen, journalists, after the June 2000 summit, when Kim Dae-jung met Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-il opened up, let 40 editors from South Korea come in and wined and dined them and talked to them. So this is a changing climate between North and South Korea, but it isn't going to happen overnight, and it isn't going to happen as fast as it could happen unless the United States softens, gets into contact, treats North Korea as a reality, distasteful reality in many ways, but a reality that we have to deal with, and recognizes that what we do will influence the balance between the hawks and doves in North Korea.
There's the place where we'll have to stop. Mr. Harrison, thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our guest, Selig Harrison, he's a former Washington Post bureau chief in Northeast Asia. His book is Korean Endgame, A Strategy for Reunification and U.S. Disengagement, published by the Princeton University Press.